Hey, it's Francis. I have another job, right? I work in book publishing too, and so I know how much work and creativity goes into every cookbook. And I also know how short the window can be for those books to be discovered before the next batch of titles comes along. So this episode is an encore from one we did last year, celebrating some of the most exciting cookbooks of that spring. And maybe you didn't know then how much you'd be cooking now, so hopefully you get inspired to check some of these authors out.
I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM. This is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Hey, okay, so I know you don't tune into the show to hear about cookbook publisher business strategy, but bear with me, this will be quick. The reason why most of the cookbooks from your favorite authors come out in October and November is because something like half of all the cookbooks sold in a year are sold just before the holidays. So publishers load up in the fall to ride that wave, and hopefully everyone ends the year happy and with jobs the next year. But as the competition got thicker, publishers started putting out more books in the spring. And these books are usually the ones, you know, that may have had a harder time breaking through the noise of the blockbusters in the fall. So spring books tend to be a little more niche, a little more geared for, passionate fans. Spring cookbooks, honestly, tend to be a little weirder and a little cooler, if you ask me. And this week, we are talking about some of the most exciting cookbooks coming out this spring. We've got a side of Cajun food you might not know about, the cuisine of the Mughal Empire, and simple home baking with a superstar pastry chef. And first, fresh vegetable cooking with Bryant Terry. Now, I first heard of Bryant, maybe 20 years ago, when he started a nonprofit program in New York City that taught underserved kids how to cook. And they made these delicious, healthy meals after school. They brought that food back home, and the kids became the spark that helped empower their families to take control of their health and diets. Bryant was brilliant and charismatic, and he's since gone on to become the chef-in-residence of the Museum of the African Diaspora. And he's the author of 4 vegan cookbooks, even though he says it's not his goal to convert anyone to veganism. He really just wants people to get down with how delicious vegetables are. Hey, Mr. Terry, how are you?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me on, Francis.
I'm psyched. It's been a while. And I actually want to start there because I remember for a while it was almost like clockwork, like every year and a half, every 2 years, there would be a new Bryant Terry cookbook. And then it's been a bit of a break. I think it's been like 6 years between your last book and this one. So
yeah,
what happened?
I
was trying to set my calendar to it.
I very intentionally took a break from writing books. As you know, writing cookbooks can be protracted, grueling, and isolating. And so I felt like I wanted to step away. And primarily, I needed to spend time with my young children. I have 2 daughters, one who is 5, another who's about to be 9. And as cliche as it may sound, my parents say it often, you never get those early years back. It's true. And I really wanted to be there in those earliest phases of their lives and create bonds with them. And, I always say that I take a lot of pride in the fact that I pretty much took my oldest daughter to every single cello lesson that she's had since she was 3, and I made it to all her recitals, and those are the type of things that we'll both look back and just be smiling about. So I don't regret it at all.
Right on. But in the 6 years since, you've been the chef at the Museum of the African Diaspora, and there's also been, I feel like, vegan cookbooks have become so much more mainstream as well. There have been so many vegan cookbooks come out in the past few years. Mm-hmm. How has your cooking style evolved over that time as well? Like, what are we seeing in this book that we weren't seeing in your other books like Afro Vegan?
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to say it's exciting to see that, there are so many quality vegan cookbooks out there.
Sure.
And not just people who are kind of dedicated to making vegan cookbooks, but you're seeing a lot of chefs who've traditionally cooked with a lot of meat or, kind of presented a more omnivorous recipes and dishes, really you know, pivoting and thinking about creative ways of working with vegetables so that, you know, this trend of people eating more plant-based, there are options for people to have and good quality options. And, you mm-hmm. know, this book was really in that spirit. And I think one thing that was important for me with this project is just revisiting a lot of basic techniques. You know, I went to culinary school 2 decades ago. And since then, I've been doing a lot of work around activism and education and programming. But, you know, I haven't spent a lot of time in kitchens and certainly not in professional kitchens. And I'm tapped a colleague and friend of mine, Monifa Dio, who specializes in Senegambian cuisine and has traveled all over the world working in some of the best kitchens globally. And she really just worked closely with me, helping me to get back to some of those core techniques. And I imparted a lot of those in this book because I think with vegetables, you know, you don't have to do a lot to them, especially if you're using farm fresh, local seasonal ingredients. You know, just wanted to show people that it's not like that big of a leap to make delicious vegetables.
Yeah. What are some recipes in the book that really speak to your style of cooking now?
Well, you know, one of the book is centered around the citrus and garlic herb braised fennel. I talk about that in the intro as that being kind of like the recipe that kind of unifies all the energy in the book. And I, you know, I kind of tongue in cheek talked about making meat. But for example, something as simple as, you know, taking a hot cast iron skillet and pan searing a steak is something that I'm sure a lot of meat eaters might be familiar with.
Sure.
And I use that technique in this recipe, you know, taking fennel and cutting it and then, you know, placing the cut side down on a cast iron skillet that's been heated really hot and then searing it until you get that nice, beautiful coat. You start to bring out some of the natural sugars in it. It caramelizes.
Yeah.
So just simple techniques, pan searing, basting, thinking about how do we garnish for aesthetic beauty. As you know, you eat with your eyes before you put it in your mouth. And I think a lot of people have these misconceptions about plant-based food or vegetarian or vegan food being bland and brown. And I just really wanted to illustrate that, you know, this it can be beautiful and it can be delicious and, you know, simple to make.
Yeah, I love lentils too, but, you know, I get it's not all lentils. No, I love the idea of searing that fennel like that because just that smell of seared fennel where you get that nice caramelization on that, especially on that cut edge, it has such a beautiful smell. It's like you have that like fresh anise licorice-y flavor, but it's like sweet and like almost like honey, but with enough salt and olive oil, it gets this really cool savory, almost like a potato-y texture on the inside. It's just, oh God, it's good.
This is one of those things that I've actually been making a lot throughout the book tour. And, you know, I've been visiting restaurants. Chef Eduardo Jordan hosted an amazing dinner in Seattle at his restaurant Solare. And that was one of the dishes that his team made. And it's been really interesting seeing people who, you know, in their mind, they have an aversion to fennel. It's like, oh, I don't like fennel. It's weird. I've had it before, but, you know, I can't really get down with that anise-like flavor. And this has been one of those dishes that I think has converted a lot of former fennel haters. And so, and, you know, just, you know, one thing I do in here that's really fun is adding that plantain powder to balance some of the acid and, you know, tamp it down a little bit and add some umami is I take plantain chips, you know, green plantain chips that have been fried and then grind them in a spice grinder or pound them in a mortar with a pestle. And then it makes this powder that I call plantain powder that, you know, I originally created to sprinkle on this dish. But let me tell you, my daughter's sprinkle that plantain powder on everything. And so
that's good. That sounds so good. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they just out of a bag from like the convenience store if you need. Like you just get like the
if you need to. You know, I'm less of a purist about using some things that are kind of pre-made, such as the plantain chips. And, you know, I used to avoid things like vegan butters and any of those kind of pre-made vegan products. But at this point, I feel like we're at a place where there's so many good quality versions of those things now. For example, Miyoko's cheese company makes this fantastic vegan butter. And so I'm certainly open to using those things when they make sense.
Right on. And, you know, this actually brings me to another question. You say that your approach to cooking is inspired by hip-hop producers, and I didn't quite know what that meant, but I'm starting to get it because I think it's about taking a little bit of this, taking a little bit of that, and sort of like remixing things. There's so much of a focus on music in the book. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, well, this idea of cooking as collage has been something that I've always drawn on. And I mean, if you think about Southern cuisine, in many ways, I see that as like the quintessential modern, quote unquote, fusion cuisine, in that you have foods from West and Central Africa that travel to the Americas. You have food from the Caribbean. You have food that are indigenous to, you know, this country, and then you had European food and cooking techniques. And so all these things, I like to see this gumbo, which is, you know, this kind of like collage, this melange of different techniques and flavor profiles and ingredients and classic dishes throughout the globe that, you know, is pretty much the basis of what I make, because the type of food that I grew up eating. And so, you know, the music is so central to the book project and all my books. As you know, I've long paired recipes with different songs. And, you know, in my mind, food and music are inseparable. Growing up in a family of musicians and artists and people who saw music as a way to bring joy and, you know, connect and bond with family. Whenever we had family gatherings, people were playing the piano and people were crooning and, you know, just having fun. And so I always like to bring that element into the books, because I don't want people to see, you know, the thing about like plant-based cooking, a lot of people kind of frame it as a tool for healing ourselves. You know, I've seen a number of people who have been pretty much eating a standard American diet, and then they'll pivot more towards a vegetable-centered diet when there's a health crisis. Or a lot of people see it as a way of kind of resisting, you know, whether it's colonialism or our industrialized food system, you know, really kind of embracing these traditional foods that are largely vegetable-based and many cuisines throughout the world. And I think that's all true, and I've certainly put a lot of emphasis on that. And right. I don't want people to lose sight of the joy and pleasure of eating. You know, that is important. And I think we need to also embrace that as something that is vitally important to our health, our well-being, our spiritual development, and all those things. Even thinking about like kind of transforming our food system, I think having joyful experiences with good food is a great way to start.
Right. Thanks so much, Brian. It's great to talk with you.
Thanks again for having me on, Francis.
Bryant Terry's latest book is Vegetable Kingdom. You can find that recipe for citrus and garlic herb braised fennel at splendidtable.org. And coming up, we imagine what the Mughal emperors will be eating today. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM.
Splendid Table is brought to you by All the Chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Saliha Mahmoud Ahmed is a doctor in London who turned her passion for cooking into a winning appearance on the British TV show MasterChef. Then she turned her other passion for culinary history into Khazana, a cookbook of dishes inspired by the long-defunct Mughal Empire. Yes, the empire that conquered Central Asia through North India and built the Taj Mahal, but what do we know about their food? The multi-talented and ever-curious Saliha is here to tell us. Hey, Saliha, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So can we start with a 60-second history of who the Mughals were?
Oh, gosh, very difficult to encapsulate in 60 seconds, but essentially...
You get 75.
All right, okay, I will work to that. Essentially, they were a group of leaders who acquired territory all the way from Samarkand in Central Asia to across Persia and Afghanistan into Pakistan and India as we formerly know it, or as we currently know it. And they sort of ruled that area between the 1500s and 1800s approximately. and the first ever Mughal emperor, which is a corruption of the word Mongol, was Babur, B-A-B-U-R, Babur. And, you know, these are really fascinating characters. Each one of these Mughal emperors had their own characteristics and traits, from fiercely aggressive to romantic to, you know, poetic, etc. But one thing that they all had in common was an incredible love for food. It's one of the fabrics that knits each Mughal emperor together. They contributed to art and history and architecture and so many different disciplines, horticulture, medicine. Their contribution to the sort of culture of that area is vast, and their effects still find themselves, or the effect that their sort of legacy has is still palpable in that region today, not just from a tourism perspective, but far, far beyond that as well.
Yeah. I mean, this is an enormous region. If you think, so Samarkand is where is Uzbekistan now, right? From there all the way to Iran. This is an enormous swath.
And further, and into India. Huge, huge. It's one of the largest empires of the world. And, you know, the sad thing about it is that when you say Mughals to people, many people, and I've been to lots of different places where I've said, who knows about the Mughals? Put your hands up when I'm demonstrating on a stage. And maybe one or two people will put their hand up. Then I say, who knows about the Taj Mahal, which, of course, as we know, is one of the quintessential Mughal monuments. And, of course, everybody will put their hand up. And it's interesting that the very few people who you first put their hands up will also only know the Mughals because of the Taj Mahal. So it's an aspect of history which we are quite naive to in the West. But actually, you know, if you think about recent history, this is an empire that dominated huge, huge surface area, huge land, and had incredible importance. So I think it's quite incredible and fascinating that we actually know so little about them when they were. I mean, they were the real shebang. You know, they were the real deal.
It's true. But their empire also ended 150 years ago. How did you get interested in cooking their food?
Well, I'm a bit of an old soul. I may look young, but I have an old heart. And I have a love for history, and I have a love for travel. So when I was a child, my parents, especially my dad, who has this incredible wanderlust and wanted to take his children all around the world and show them things that other people didn't. I mean, it wasn't usual to go on holiday to Central Asia at that time. My friends were going to the south of Spain and the south of France, you know. And my dad, you know, would take us to lots of different remote places. And quite often those places were the territories that the Mughals had conquered. And in so doing, he imparted in us a love for Mughal art and architecture and culture. We had books at home. We had Mughal-inspired paintings at home. We brought back artifacts that were influenced by Mughal design. So there was this huge sort of influence. And Mum and Dad they actually grew up in Pakistan. And they actually used to say to us, you know, the way you studied the Tudors or the Aztecs at school, you know, we actually studied the Mughals. And that's sort of where the seed was planted. And food was constructed in those traveling memories. So, you know, I remember being outside the Taj Mahal, and I remember the food I ate outside the Taj Mahal, which was in the form of a chaat, which is like a street food snack. I have lots and lots of these sort of very rich culinary memories that I formed along the way as we travelled. And so I think that's where the love and fascination began. But you see, for you, you may feel that, yes, these are 150 years old and, yes, they have an influence on art and architecture. But for me, the feeling of them being alive was very palpable because they formed the connection that I had between myself and my parents at that moment in time doing something very special. And not only that, I began seeing the influence of the Mughals in modern-day Indian films, Bollywood films that we would watch, in fabrics that we would buy. And as I gradually started actually writing my book, more and more became apparent. So, you know, these sort of These sort of things are, to us, we don't think about the origins of them. But 150 years is actually not that long ago.
That's fair. That's totally fair. Right? Okay, but speaking of the history of it, your cookbook is a contemporary Mughal cookbook, in a sense, right? These aren't traditional Mughal dishes. The recipes are your own inventions. But what about them makes them feel like Mughal food to you? Like, what are the characteristics of Mughal food?
The characteristics. Well, you see, one of the characteristics of the Mughals was that they were not scared and didn't shirk off invention. And I think it's very important to remember that about them. They were creative. They did not worry about trying things that were just a little bit different, whether that's in the kitchen or otherwise. And so the spirit of invention is very much there in the book. The ingredients, I think, that I use in the book are extremely characteristic of Mughal cuisine. Because Mughal cuisine is not fiery, spicy, blow your head off hot in any way, shape or form. Rather, it's this very complex dichotomy of rich, luxurious ingredients like cashews and ghee and butter and things which are quite, you know, heavy and opulent. And then actually quite light, fragrant spicing. So saffron and cardamom and star anise and, you know, beautiful light spices. I mean, the chili that I use is often in the form of, you know, a sprinkling of chili flakes rather than huge mounds of green chili. You know, the focus is on sort of scents, rose water. And there are favourite ingredients in the book. So rose certainly plays an extremely heavy role in the book. Saffron plays a very heavy role in the book. Pomegranates. I mean, when you dig deep, you find that the Mughals are joyously, joyously in love with ingredients. And I think that is the most beautiful, beautiful thing. They took such care, even with their poultry and game, etc. So their chickens, for example, would be fed pellets of saffron and pellets of pearls and other, you know, beautiful, delicious things, because they felt that if they fed their poultry these things, then, you know, the meat would actually taste much better. The poultry drank rose water because they thought that would influence the flesh of the chicken. I mean, how amazing is that? They also massaged their poultry with musk and sandalwood. I mean, I swear to God, they took more care of their chickens than I could take of care of myself in a year.
Sounds like a great spa.
Yeah, exactly. They absolutely got spa treatment. And they imported damask roses from Samarkand. You know, they had complex series of runners who essentially bought fruit all the way from Samarkand to India because the emperors felt that, God forbid, the fruit of India wasn't good enough for them. You know, in fact, one Mughal emperor called Babur, he was so amazing. I mean, this man killed people. He slayed. He was a warrior. You know, he was, you know, descendant of Genghis Khan. But this man cried when, after some years, he found a watermelon that had been transported from his native Samarkand to Hindustan. He cried when he ate a melon, but he killed thousands of people. I mean, that is incredible to me. That to me, just epitomizes how crazy about food these people were. You know, they're bonkers. They're absolutely bonkers. It's true.
Something I loved seeing in your book, in addition to just these gorgeous sounding recipes, like there's a sea bass with chili and saffron butter baked in lavash that I just can't wait to eat. But something I see in this book are these cooking techniques that you talk about being key to Mughal food. Some of them I want to ask you about. Can you tell us about dundar and how you use it?
Duandar, let's pronounce it. So, you know, you see these Mughal words. I love pronouncing them because I can speak Urdu. So they are, you've got to say it with a umph. Duandar. Okay. Right? So duandar, yeah, duandar basically is a form of smoking. So essentially what happens is that the Mughals would want to smoke some raw meat, for example. And what they would do is marinate their meat and put it in big bowls, usually copper it would tend to be, but really any bowl which had a sturdy lid attached to it. Then they would find a piece of coal, which they would heat up till it was blazingly hot. I mean, really, really hot as you can imagine. And they would place that piece of coal on top of the chicken, usually on another little copper vessel or a spoon or something, so that it wasn't directly touching the meat. And then as rapidly as they could, before that coal cooled down at all, they would drop a couple of drops of oil. It doesn't have to be a flavoured oil. It could be any oil, just some vegetable oil or something, or ghee. And usually some spices as well, perhaps some cloves they could put on there, or star anise or something, cardamom maybe, to give that oil a scent. That's optional though. And then they would very quickly, as rapidly as they can, put a lid on top of that marinating meat, and then just leave it to sit so that smoky taste would infuse into the meat. Now, I saw my aunt in Pakistan doing this once with some barbecue she was about to make. And I said to her, I don't get it. You're going to burn it, but you're smoking it before you burn it. She was like, just trust me. You don't know. You just trust me. It just makes a difference. This was years ago. And I think I was probably about 8 or 9 years old when I saw her do it. And at the time, I didn't realize it was a Mughal technique. And it is actually used, not that commonly, but it is used across South Asia as a smoking technique. But yes, it's quite amazing, isn't it? And having tried it, you know, it's far superior to any other smoking technique that I've ever tried, particularly wood chip smoking. It gives a much stronger flavor, actually, of smoke than other things. Mm-hmm.
And the smoke from oil is very different than the smoke from wood. So I'm sure it's, even for people who love wood smoked food, I'm sure this is a really different experience. What are some dishes in the book that use it?
To be honest, I just put the one in. the one dish that uses that particular smoking technique is the smoked basil kebabs with beetroot raita. And it's a beautiful dish, very summery. So it's essentially a marinade that I make with yogurt and basil and lots of other spices and maybe some garlic and ginger and things. And you marinate that and then you essentially smoke it with coal before... With chicken, yes, with chicken. Yeah. But, you know, I think as a technique, it's extremely versatile. So you can do it to any other meat that you want to then marinate and then roast or grill. Grilling, really, I think, or barbecuing is the next step to this. So although in my recipes, again, you know, I'm a great believer in making things accessible. I live in England. It rains here all the time. Barbecues, you know, are very, very rare. So I thought, you know, if I'm writing this, I have to write it for an audience who can and can't barbecue. So actually, the recipe says that you can either barbecue it, or you can bake it, or you can roast it, so that it's quite versatile. Because when you've imparted that smoky flavour, all you're doing in the secondary process is then enhancing it rather than, you know, that being the index way of getting flavour into the meat, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about tarka.
Tarka. Tarka, otherwise pronounced tarka, is
a... Let me try.
Go on.
Tarka.
Yeah, very good. Very good, Francis. Okay. So, dhuandar and tarka. You'll be practicing in the shower later. Tarka is a method whereby fat is heated up in a pan. And when it's just before sort of smoking point, you add a series of spices. Now, this is usually in the form of curry leaves or mustard seeds, cumin seeds, and some turmeric right at the end, perhaps even some chili. Sometimes you can add a bit of finely chopped garlic. And it's a very, very quick technique, so you work very quickly. As soon as those spices start popping and releasing their aromas, the key is not to burn. You mustn't burn. You must just see those spices coming to life and becoming this intoxicating fume of spice, you know, heady spice that's just filling up the room. You then pour all of that hot fat onto your dish. Typically, you apply tarka to lentil dishes. So you'll have your boiled up lentils and then you pour the hot fat over and that sort of flavours them. But I sort of changed, I went sort of upside down on that concept of why does hot fat need to only be applied to cook lentil dishes? I mean, this is a beautiful way of imparting flavour. So I essentially apply a tarka to grated carrots. You can do it to grated beetroot or finely chopped fennel or, you know, anything you like, really. And what it does is it just takes that rawness out of the carrots. And if you leave it to then stand...
Cool.
It softens, and then the spiced oil then finds its way in through the membranes of the carrot to make them, you know, really, really deeply, intensely flavoursome. And then I just top it off with a bit of extra lemon juice, a tiny bit of maple syrup or honey, some herbs like fresh coriander, not cilantro. And you see, I'm British. And, you know, and then I serve it very quickly. And it's an absolutely glorious thing.
That sounds so great. And that's a totally... like you said, a modern dish using this very old inspiration. Thanks so much, Saliha.
Thank you so much. It's been fabulous.
Saliha Mahmood Ahmed is the author of Khazana, which the UK newspaper The Guardian named the best new cookbook of the year. You can find a recipe for smoked chicken and basil kebabs, and it uses that charcoal smoking technique she talked about, at splendidtable.org. Coming up, a real-life look at Cajun cooking with New Orleans chef Melissa Martin. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. When I say the words Cajun food, do you think big, spicy, blackened, lots of people yelling, bam, in the kitchen? Well, Melissa Martin was raised in the bayou in Chauvin, Louisiana, and the food she grew up with wasn't much like what we see on TV. She has a restaurant in New Orleans where she serves the home cooking that takes her back to her mother's kitchen. It's called the Mosquito Supper Club, which is also the name of her debut cookbook, and it's a beautiful portrait of the coastal Louisiana she remembers. We're so glad to talk with her about it. Hey, Chef, thanks so much for coming today.
Thank you for having me.
Your book is beautiful, and it's so full of really, I think, intimate descriptions of the place where you grew up in the bayou in southern Louisiana. But I really want to start with, what was mealtime like when you were a kid? Like, did you cook at all?
I didn't cook. I was one of six kids, and my mom cooked three meals a day. I was very lucky. My mom cooked three meals a day. But we all ate together as a family at the table. There were a lot of us. We didn't all fit at the table. So sometimes it was like in shifts. But I always say we ate like kings.
Mm. And what were some of the things you were eating?
Anything that was on my mom's repertoire. So jambalaya and gumbo and beans and fried fish and fried shrimp, boiled seafood, those things.
Yeah. And many years later, as I read in your book, you were in California, right?
Yes.
You were a Katrina evacuee when you kind of realized you wanted to be a chef and that you needed to cook the food you grew up with. What happened?
So I spent some time back in the city after Katrina, living in the Treme, and then I took an opportunity to learn how to make wine in the Napa Valley. Mm-hmm. So I spent some time as I call it a harvest rat, and it was the first time I'd ever been to California, and my eyes just sort of got wide at the culinary scene. And so I knew I wanted to work in some restaurants there and learn. And so I got a couple of different cooking gigs, and I worked with some incredible chefs. And that experience definitely opened up my eyes to seasonal cooking, because California has all these incredible systems in place. But it also allowed me to connect how I ate growing up to how people were eating in the Napa Valley. And, you know, what was becoming this like catchy farm to table thing, I was almost confused about it because it's just how we lived on the bayou.
Mm. tell us about the food on the bayou, right? Because I think, and you say it yourself, you're right that, you know, Cajun food and culture are often misrepresented. And I think in the larger, you know, culture, those of us who haven't spent time in Louisiana, and maybe even those of us who have, you know, this idea of quote-unquote Cajun food comes from the 80s, comes from Paul Prudhomme, comes from, you know, Black and Redfish, which, I, as I later learned, is really a restaurant dish and wasn't really a dish that people really had in homes.
Right. I definitely never had Black and Redfish.
Really?
Never.
Yeah, but the rest of us around the country are like, oh, blackened food, like that's what Cajun food is. But
yeah,
that's not really how you ate at all.
No, I mean, one of the things that I do in the cookbook is try to dispel myths, many Cajun myths. Mm. One, that our food is spicy. I never had spicy food growing up, but it's just my mom made it really balanced so all her children would eat it. Mm. So, you know, there's that. And, you know, there's just an idea of what Cajun food is. And, you know, it's true that every family has a different gumbo, a different jambalaya, a different etouffee, a different stew. So what I tried to do in the book is just focus on the simple food that we ate down in this micro region in Louisiana that was heavily influenced by the seafood industry around us. All of my family were shrimpers and crabbers and oyster fishermen. So that was the ingredients that dictated what my mom would make on any given day, or what my grandmother would make, or, you know, my mom's sisters would make. It was all the women that were cooking on the bayou. Men would oftentimes cook in seafood boils, but in my family, you know, my dad made cornflakes. So I think that with the book, I wanted to show how simple it was for me growing up, and I didn't want there to be any smoke and mirrors. I think Cajun gets, what's the word I'm looking for? It's often represented as this big thing. I mean, Emeril Lagasse represented it as this, you know, big bam. Right. And yes, it has a lot of energy in it, but it's really simple for me. The rhythms of the bayou and what happened on the table is much simpler than it's represented.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, we like to gather as big groups and eat together, but, you know, it's simpler than I think it's been represented.
Sure. What are some of the dishes that you like to make now that you feel really speak to your family and what you grew up with?
So at the restaurant, we always have some dishes that I just can't take off the menu. So the gumbos that we cook are shrimp, okra, and crab gumbo. Gumbo and okra are the same word. Mm. And we like to share that dish with our customers who come in, because it's a gumbo that isn't necessarily cooked in New Orleans and I haven't seen anywhere else. It's a gumbo without a roux. Most people expect a roux when they have their gumbo. So we love to have that on the menu. During oyster season, we love to have my grandmother's oyster soup, another soup that I never had anywhere else.
Tell us about that oyster soup.
So that's a soup that's made with oyster liquor. So my grandfather was an oyster fisherman, and my great-grandfather, and my dad met my mom oyster fishing with her dad. So one thing, if you're an oyster fisherman, is you have a lot of oysters, and you're shucking those oysters into containers, and you have all this extra liquor. And so we make this oyster soup with like a gallon and a half of oyster liquor, which you can only really get if you're shucking them yourself.
Yeah.
And so that's the base of it. Whereas someone might use stock for the soup, the base is just this like delicious briny
pure oyster juice. Oh my
yeah,
God.
And we just cook it with cook it with onions and garlic and fresh tomatoes from the farmer's market, and you know, we add our oysters in at the last minute. And you know, it's just this delicious soup that when I eat it, I could see it in, you know, sort of raked across Basque country. It's almost like a bouillabaisse or something that you would have in Western France in a little fishing village.
That's so interesting. Well, first of all, yeah, like I think that dish sounds incredible because it's, you're right, like that is something you wouldn't really ever have if oystering isn't part of your lifestyle, if that's not in your family, because it would be so ridiculously decadent to go get
a gallon and a half of oyster juice unless you're swimming in it.
Yeah, and that's just like growing up, it was just there. The ingredients were just there. You had a seafood boil and you had crabs left over and you picked that crab and then you made crab cakes. But to start from scratch and not have this like abundance of seafood around you, whether it be crabs or oyster liquor or crawfish, then you're looking at a much steeper price just because of the way the industry has changed. And right now, currently, I don't live in a fishing village. I live in the city of New Orleans. But even for my parents down on the bayou, it's harder for them to have those ingredients on hand as they get older. And the people of the community, you know, not everyone is making a career in fishing. It's become really, really difficult. So,
yeah. And that's one of the reasons I really appreciate your book, because it is a snapshot of this place that, you know, and I think this is a much larger conversation, but is really changing because of climate change, is really changing because of technology and the economy changing. And it's really amazing to travel to this place that you're from, the fishing villages and the communities of the bayou. So thank you so much for this, Jeff. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Melissa Martin is the author of Mosquito Supper Club. If you go to splendidtable.org, you can find her recipe for smothered chicken, which our producer Sally made and literally cannot stop talking about. She even sent me a picture of herself from her kitchen with goggles on because you have to cut 3 pounds of onions for it, but she swears it was beyond worth it. A few years ago, a pastry chef named Dominique Ancel shaped croissant dough into a ring, fried it until puffy, and became the creator of the Cronut, which is one of the world's most copied pastries. He also became a master maker of lines, and by that I mean hours-long lines outside his bakeries, people waiting for cronuts, waiting for the frozen s'mores they light on fire, waiting for the mugs of hot chocolate where the marshmallows literally open up and blossom like flowers before your eyes. I have no idea how he does it. But anyway, while Dominique has made his name with these magical treats, his new book is for the non-magicians among us. It's called Everyone Can Bake. It's filled with the simple fillings and doughs that are his foundation, and our friend Melissa Clark met up with him to talk about some of these basic building blocks.
Dominique, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I see you've brought me some treats. What did you bring?
Yes, I brought you a beautiful raspberry tart and some Linzer cookies.
Oh my gosh, you're the best guest ever. So you have a new book, and I know that this book is different from your last book in that it's made for beginning bakers, right? And that you've taken recipes and you've broken them into components.
That's right. So for this new book, I want to be a different approach to baking, something a bit more simple and something a bit more substantial as well. So I've broken down the book by 3 different sections. The base, which essentially is all the biscuit, all the cakes, all the meringues, the tart shells, all the base to build your foundations for your cake. Then you have the fillings, which is all the cream, buttercream, whipped cream, ganaches, everything that is going to be the cement of the cake.
Uh-huh.
And the last part will be the finishings, cut fruits, caramelized fruits, pipe cream, glazed cakes.
Great. And so, for example, this tart is something from each section, right? You have the base.
That's right, which is the tart shell.
Uh-huh. And Matt, tell me about the tart shell.
So the tart shell is a simple vanilla sablé.
Okay.
So the vanilla sablé can be used as a tart shell, but also the base for the Linzer cookies.
So basically, it's this one component, this one recipe, and you're using it in all kinds of different ways.
Exactly.
And then what's the filling? I can see it oozing out a little bit. It looks so good.
The filling is a very nice, simple vanilla pastry cream made with like eggs, cream, a little bit of butter, milk. So that's the foundation for our tart. And there's a little bit of raspberry jam inside as well.
And then the top, I wish you could see this, but it's beautiful, fresh raspberries.
It's finished simply with like beautiful, fresh raspberries on top. Yes, exactly.
So the pastry cream. So again, that's also a component, a building block. What else can you do with that one?
So with the pastry cream, essentially, it's a foundation for a lot of different creams. So the pastry cream itself can be used for a tart. We can make something that's called a chiboust, mm-hmm. which is a pastry cream mixed with a little bit of meringue. And that's a filling for cake as well.
What does the meringue do? Does it make it lighter?
The meringue just makes it lighter, gives a different texture. So the pastry cream can be like creamy and like dense and like smooth.
Uh-huh.
If you add meringue to it, it's a different texture. No, it's
like a mousse.
Almost like a mousse.
And then I also saw that sometimes you infuse flavors into the pastry cream, like herbs.
Yes, you can do a lot. In my ideal scenario of work, teaching people, I teach you how to create. So there's a lot of different ways you can be creative. And just infusing, for example, like hazelnut or almonds in the cream, you can make an almond pastry cream very easily. You mentioned herbs. You can do spices. You're just infusing something in your milk, in your base, and you can transform this pastry cream into like something different.
So this is very freeing for home bakers, because once they learn your go-to pastry cream, then they can take it in all kinds of different directions, just like a pastry chef would in a restaurant.
Exactly. That's what essentially I do in my kitchen every day.
And I know that you also have a recipe for one of my favorite things, chocolate ganache. So yes. That's another building block. That would be a filling, right?
That would be a filling, but it can be used for different things as well. We have different kind of ganaches. So a ganache is essentially a cream with chocolate and this like pasty, chocolatey texture, almost like a fudge.
Like a chocolate truffle is a ganache.
Exactly, chocolate truffle. So we can use this ganache recipe for a chocolate truffle, but we can also use it to glaze a cake. Exactly.
And it's not hard to make, right, ganache?
It's pretty easy to make. The recipe I have in this book is essentially a crème anglaise, which is eggs, sugar, and milk that you cook. And then you pour this over the chocolate. That's pretty much it.
Now, that's a little bit different. Most of the chocolate ganache I've made in the past is just warm cream and then the chopped chocolate. But you make a custard, a crème anglaise. Why is that?
Exactly. It's just for the texture more than anything else. When you eat it, it's like creamier.
Uh-huh.
So the texture is much, much better and gives you much better flavor in terms of chocolate. Making it with just cream and chocolate works as well. It's a different recipe that I don't have in the book, but
right.
There's hundreds and hundreds of recipes out there to make a ganache.
I can't wait to try yours. So you can take that same sablé tart shell, like with the raspberry tart, but add chocolate and then come up with something completely new.
Yes. So all the recipes in the book are pretty versatile. So they can be used and flavored differently and modified slightly into making something different.
And now let's talk about a dessert that you feature pretty prominently in your book, but that I think a lot of home bakers don't make, and that's pâte à choux. Talk about that as a base. What is pâte à choux?
So pâte à choux is a cream puff in French, and pâte à choux is the foundation of French baking. It's used in many, many different preparations in the kitchen. It's also, I will say, a simple recipe to do. It's really, really easy. You cook some milk with a little bit of butter, salt, sugar, then you add the flour. You cook it just a little bit. You put it in the mixer.
So you cook the flour.
You cook the flour with the milk. It's like a dough almost. You cook it on the stove for a few minutes until it dries out a little bit. Then you put it in the mixer. And then from there, you add a little bit of eggs. So you'll have this like pasty, like thick dough.
Right.
And then you can pipe. And this will be used to make cream puff, eclairs, profiteroles
and
religieuses and many, many other things in the kitchen.
So cream puffs are that same dough, the pâte à choux with pastry cream, and then the profiteroles have ice cream, right? That's the difference.
That's
I
right.
always get those mixed up.
That's right. And the same dough, it's not in the book, but the same dough could be used for what we call gougères. Gougères are essentially the savory version of it, which you can flavor with like salt and pepper, a little bit of spice, and this is a perfect snack for aperitif as
well. I love those. My favorite with champagne, right?
Mm-hmm.
A little early for that now. Okay, so if you were going to tell a home baker to up their baking game by making one of the recipes in your book, which one would it be?
Oh, that's a great question. What I like to suggest people is to always to, for example, this raspberry tart, to take this a simple recipe, and we've talked about modifying slightly the sablé, making a chocolate sablé, a hazelnut sablé, by adding a few different ingredients, the pastry cream as well. So you could be doing a chocolate sablé with a hazelnut pastry cream, for example, the raspberry jam inside and fresh raspberries. So now you have a whole new different tart.
Right, so with one recipe.
With one recipe, by being like still creative, adding and flavoring your own recipe.
Okay, so speaking of that tart, can we try it?
Yes,
it looks amazing.
I have a slice for you right here.
Oh my gosh, Dominique, I'm going to sit here and eat this, but I'm going to thank you first for coming in and talking to us today. You're amazing.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
Dominique Ansel's new book is Everyone Can Bake. You can find his recipes for vanilla sablé tart shell, pastry cream, and chocolate ganache
at splendidtable.org. And Melissa Clark, our dear friend, she has a new book this spring too. Look out for Dinner in French, My Recipes by Way of France. And that is our show for the week. We hope you fall in love with a new cookbook or two this season. We'll talk to you next week. You can subscribe to our podcast at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to get them. You can also get our weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen. We deliver a recipe straight to your inbox every Wednesday to make your dinner time a little easier. Sign up at splendidtable.org. The show comes together with the work of our team, Jenny Lupke, Erica Romero, and Sally Swift. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.